The last couple of weeks, we looked at stories of the Jews while they were in exile in Babylon, when we looked at the stories in the book of Daniel. Next week, we will see how the Jews return to Israel, return to Jerusalem, return to Judah. There's a number of returns. We'll look especially at the returns under Ezra and under Nehemiah. And that will conclude our stories in the Old Testament. And then after that, we'll move on into looking at, we'll move towards the New Testament. First, we'll take a look at God's eternal plan, and we'll spend the next quarter looking at how God didn't change his mind when the New Testament came around. Rather, he just continued his plan and completed his plan through Jesus Christ, and we'll be looking at that. Today, we're going to look at a story that takes place while the some of the Jews are still around in Babylon, or now that Babylon, as we saw last week, was conquered by Persia, some of them moved on to other places in Persia. And we'll see that in the story of Esther. To kind of bring us back there, because we've really covered a lot of ground over the past number of months. We've seen a lot of history of Israel. Let's kind of run ourselves real quickly just through a quick overview of the history of the Jews in the Promised Land. When they come to the Promised Land, well, first we see stories of the Jews in Promised Land with the patriarchs, with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Although they never owned any of that land except for a small burial plot that Abraham bought to bury his wife Sarah, they were nomads there, but God promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob that all that land that they see would become theirs. That was the Promised Land. And later on, after 460 years in Egypt and preparing them and turning them into from a family into a people, God brings them out and brings them into the Promised Land. After they are given the Promised Land through miraculous conquests that God brought about, they now have their land. So what kind of government did they start out with after they settled in the Promised Land? If you look in Judges 17:6, and this is repeated a few times, but in 17:6 it says that in those days Israel had no king. Everyone did as he saw fit. And that's what you had at the beginning. For the first number of years, it was more of a loose confederacy. After Moses, you had Joshua. But then after Joshua, there was no central leader. Okay, there was no central ruler, central king. It was more of a loose confederacy. And as you look at the stories in the book of Judges, you see that sometimes the tribes would come together and support each other. Sometimes they would even fight against each other. But they had no king. Now, actually, they did. They had the greatest king you could ever have, and that is God. That is Yahweh. The problems came, though, when they didn't follow that king, when they turned to other kings, when they turned to other gods, when they didn't obey that king, when they didn't obey God. And eventually, as God brought his judgment on them and allowed the neighboring countries and peoples to create problems for the Israelites, they recognized their problem in that they weren't following their king, but they didn't see that God was their king. And so how did all this change after years of troubles with neighboring peoples, especially the Philistines, which is really what brought it to a head? In 1 Samuel chapter 8, starting verse 19, the people refused to listen to Samuel, the prophet. No, they said, we want a king over us. Then we'll be just like all the other nations, with a king to lead us and to go out before us and to fight our battles. So that's what they wanted. They wanted a king. Okay? Samuel tried to explain to them, you've got a king. You've got the greatest king ever with God. Just follow him. But if you want an earthly king, there's prices to pay. You're going to be taxed. You're going to be have your children drafted into the army and into service for the king and all of that. And that's what he describes in this. And they say, no, we want to have a king just like all the other nations. Going on. When Samuel heard that all the people said, he repeated it before Yahweh. Yahweh answered, listen to him and give him a king. Okay? So God told him to give him a king. So, did Samuel pick the first king? Who selected that first king? next chapter, chapter 9, verse 15, says, "Now the day before Saul came, Yahweh had revealed this to Samuel. About this time tomorrow, I will send you a man from the land of Benjamin. Anoint him leader over my people Israel. He will deliver my people from the hand of the Philistines. I've looked upon my people, for their cry has reached me." When Samuel caught the sight of Saul, Yahweh said to him, "This is the man that I spoke to you about. He will govern my people." So who picked the first king? God did. In fact, God brought the first king, Saul, to Samuel and told him to anoint him. Samuel had no idea who Saul was before God brought him like this. So God picked him. But Saul stopped being king, and he was replaced then by David. Why did David become king? Was it because David wanted to be king and he had personal ambitions and he did everything he could to become king? 1 Samuel chapter 16, we'll just read a few verses. Verse 1, Yahweh said to Samuel, "How long will you mourn for Saul since I've rejected him as king over Israel? Fill your horn with oil and be on your way. I'm sending you to Jesse of Bethlehem. I've chosen one of his sons to become king." Okay? Because Saul was not leading the people as God intended. Saul was not faithful to God, was not trusting of God, did not have a heart after God. And so therefore, God rejected him as king and said, "Look, I've picked someone else, the next king. Go over to this guy's house and one of his sons." So you then have the story where he goes to Jesse's house. Jesse has eight sons and parades seven of them, the seven oldest, in front of him. And Samuel says in verse 10, "Yahweh has not chosen these." So he asked Jesse, "Are these all the sons you have?" "Well, they're still the youngest," Jesse answered, "but he's tending sheep." Samuel said, "Well, send for him. We won't sit down until he arrives." So he sent and had him brought in. He was ruddy with a fine appearance and handsome features. So he was very young and didn't look like a kingly kind of person, where Saul did. Saul was a big, burly, heavy-duty kind of guy that looked like a king, tall to the people. David was a young boy at this time and didn't look like a king at all. But Yahweh said, "Rise and anoint him, for he is the one." So God chose David. And in all our stories, we see that David never tried to take the kingdom away from Saul. And he followed the Lord, and the Lord had chosen him. Okay, we also see that God chose David's son Solomon, who was not the firstborn, the secondborn, or the thirdborn son of David. God chose Solomon to be the next king. And then Solomon, we see, eventually grew unfaithful. And so how did God react to that? 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 9. Yahweh became angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from Yahweh, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice. Although he had forbidden Solomon to follow other gods, Solomon did not keep Yahweh's command. So Yahweh said to Solomon, "Since this is your attitude, and you have not kept my covenant and my decrees, which I have commanded you, I will most certainly tear the kingdom away from you and give it to one of your subordinates. Nevertheless, for the sake of David, your father, I will not do it during your lifetime. I'll tear it out of the hand of your son. Yet I will not tear out the whole kingdom from him, but I'll give him one tribe for the sake of David, my servant, for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." So because of Solomon's unfaithfulness, God decided to take the nation away from David's family, from Solomon's family. Except because of David's faithfulness and his promise to David to always have a descendant on the throne, God decided he was going to take all but one tribe, okay? And the other tribes would then go to the north. And so you had a split of the nation, which you kind of see down at the bottom little timeline that we're kind of walking through here at the bottom of your page, that you have a split in the kingdom into a northern kingdom of Israel and a southern kingdom of Judah. Now, these had their own different histories, and we've looked at that over the months. What happened over the next 200 years to the northern nation of Israel? Turn to 2 Kings chapter 17, starting at verse 21. And this is where we get kind of a summary of the story. When God tore Israel away from the house of David, they made Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, their king. Jeroboam enticed Israel away from following Yahweh and caused them to commit a great sin. So from the very first king of the northern nation of Israel, the people were led astray and the people turned away from God and worshiped gods that Jeroboam made up. And then going on, the Israelites persisted in all the sins of Jeroboam and did not turn away from them until Yahweh removed them from his presence, as he had warned them through all his servants, the prophets. So although God continued to call them from time to time and over again through prophets and servants, they persisted in the sins of Jeroboam, persisted in following the religion that he made up and turning away from God. So the people of Israel were taken from their homeland into exile in Assyria, and they are still there. Okay, they were not taken and put into one place to where they could stay a people and return. They were scattered, and as a result, they're still there. They merged with the other peoples in the areas, and that northern tribe ceased to exist, except for the faithful who had gone south to the southern nation. When Jeroboam created his religions, the priests and the faithful Israelites moved south and went to Judah, the southern nation. Okay, and that strengthened Judah. And you'll see that over the years too, as the faithful pop up in Israel, they typically moved south. Okay, so the faithful are what remained in the south. Well, what happened to the south? What happened to the southern nation of Judah? And it lasted, you see, a little bit longer, 350 years. You can kind of see on the little chart at the bottom that Israel kind of died off, and then 150 years later, you see the decline or captivity of the southern nation of Judah. So what happened there? Well, Jeremiah gives us a little story there to remind us of what happened. Jeremiah chapter 25, starting at verse 4, Jeremiah summarizes, "And though the Lord sent all his servants the prophets to you again and again, you have not listened or paid any attention." It sounds like he's talking to the northern nation of Israel. And sure enough, that was the case. But he's talking to the southern nation of Judah. They also had trouble following God. Okay, we saw in their history some positive times where there was a strong king, a faithful king, such as a Hezekiah or Josiah or Uzziah, some of these that turned the people back to God, but there was a lot that turned them away as well. And Jeremiah goes on to say that these prophets said, "Turn now, each of you, from your evil ways and your evil practices, and you can stay in the land that the Lord gave you and your fathers forever and ever." So as long as you're faithful to God, he will continue to bless you with this land and leave you in this land. "But you didn't listen to me," verse 7, "and you've provoked me with what your hands have made, and you've brought harm to yourselves," declared the Lord. "Therefore, the Lord Almighty says this, because you have not listened to my words, I will summon all the peoples of the north, and my servant Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, declares the Lord, and I will bring them against this land and its inhabitants, and against all the surrounding nations. I will completely destroy them and make them an object of horror and scorn and an everlasting ruin." So by following the evil ways of their sister, Israel, even though they saw the destruction, even though they saw the punishment that God meted out on them for their lack of faith, they followed in Israel's ways. And as a result, God gave them over to Babylon, the Babylonians. And there we see that they were in Babylon. Now, Jeremiah does say that they would be there for 70 years. That was a term that God had prescribed that they would be there. And then we saw the stories in the book of Daniel that happened while they were in Babylon. While they were there in Babylon, as the time grew near to the 70 years, God made something happen that put things in motion for the conclusion of that 70 years. We see in Daniel chapter 5, starting verse 22. And this is Daniel telling the king Belshazzar, who's the king of the Babylonians at the time, what God is going to do here. He says, "But you, his son, O Belshazzar, have not humbled yourself, though you knew all of this. Instead, you've set yourself up against the Lord of heaven. You had goblets from his temple brought to you, and you and your nobles, your wives and your concubines drank wine from them. You praised the gods of silver and gold and bronze and iron and wood and stone, which are no gods at all. They cannot see or hear or understand. But you did not honor the God who holds in his hand your life and all of your ways. So that very night, verse 30, Belshazzar, king of the Babylonians, was slain. And Darius the Mede, the Persian, took over the kingdom at the age of 62. So Babylon was conquered by Persia. And that set things in motion to prepare the Jews to go back. And we'll see this next week. But you can see the very first verses of the book of Ezra. It says that in the first year of Cyrus, the king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord spoken by Jeremiah, the Lord moved the heart of Cyrus, the king of Persia, to make a proclamation throughout his realm and to put it in writing. This is what Cyrus, the king of Persia, says. Yahweh, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build a temple for him at Jerusalem in Judah. Any one of his people among you, may his God be with him, and let him go up to Jerusalem in Judah and build the temple of Yahweh, the God of Israel, the God who is in Jerusalem. So the Persians then, under Cyrus, allowed the Jews to return to rebuild the temple. And when did that happen? It happened 70 years after the Jews were brought into exile into Babylon. Now, it's during this time and before Ezra, well, it's after this first return, but before Ezra goes, and we'll talk more about that next week, that we then have the story of Esther. So you see that on your little timeline at the bottom. But you can see Esther chapter 1 says that this happened, the story of Esther happened during the time of Xerxes. That is the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush, because there were a couple of Xerxes. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. So that ties it down. And this is during Xerxes' reign, which was 54 years after the first return, 54 years after Cyrus provided that edict that we saw at the beginning of the book of Ezra. This also happened about 25 years before Ezra then goes to Jerusalem, which we'll talk about. And you can see the timeline here on page 2, that under 537 B.C. is when the Jews returned under Cyrus to rebuild the temple. And it was completed, the temple was completed by 516 B.C. And then we have the story of Esther. 473 is the first Purim, which that'll make more sense to you later on as we go through this story. And then 458 B.C. is when we see Ezra going to Jerusalem, and 445 B.C. is when Nehemiah goes to Jerusalem. So that kind of puts it in timing and perspective here for you. Okay, so that's why we're covering the story of Esther before we cover Ezra and Nehemiah, even though Ezra and Nehemiah books come before Esther in the Bible, because Ezra starts out before Esther, okay, that we just saw in chapter 1, verses 1 to 3 of Ezra, if that makes sense. Okay. All right. One interesting thing about this book of Esther is that this is the only book in the Bible that does not give the name of God. It does not mention God. It does not even refer to God. Okay, it's not even stated, mentioned, or even referred to in this book. But it does. But God is throughout this book. God is very obvious in this book. It's a very strong story about how God cares for his people and loves his people and saves his people and protects his people. There's this kind of a root message of this book. Paul summarized later in Romans 8:28. Many of you could probably just recite that. And Paul said that we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who have been called according to his purpose. Now that doesn't say that God always works good in all things, or that God makes all things good, but in all things that happen, good or bad, God can work his good. The story of Joseph is a great example of that. Of all the horrible things that happened to Joseph, look at all the good that came out of it. Okay? Joseph even told his brothers, "You did this intending to harm me, but God did this through you for the salvation of many people, to save many lives." Another Joseph, that is Jesus, is another great example. Look at all the horrible things that happened to him, the way that he was brutally tortured and killed. But look at the great good that came from that, the salvation of all people. Now, there's a key verse in this story that really kind of summarizes it as well. Esther chapter 4, verse 14. And This is Mordecai, which is Esther's cousin. We'll get into that, talking to her. And he says, if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arrive from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. Who knows? You may be in the current position that you're in. Whatever situation that you're in, you may be in that position because that's what God's got planned, and God has some great things planned to work through you in that. Okay? So how is God using the circumstances of your life to accomplish His will? And that's what we see here in the story of Esther. So let's look at the story. Okay? We've got 10 chapters to cover this morning. So we'll zoom through them pretty quick. We're not going to have time to read every verse, but you'll get the gist of it here. Now, this is when Xerxes is king, and Xerxes, the Persians, when they conquered Babylon, they took all the wealth of Babylon with that, which was pretty great. You think of the greatness of Nebuchadnezzar, and we talked about how great of a city Babylon was. And so all that wealth became theirs, and as well as more, and things continued to grow. And Xerxes was very wealthy and had great power. So how proud of his wealth and power was he? Going on chapter 1 of Esther, verse 4. For a full 180 days, 6 months, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor of the glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king held a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people, from the least to the greatest, who were in the citadel of Susa. Okay, Susa was the capital, which we saw back in verse 2, that was the capital of Persia at the time, where the king was. Zoom into verse 9, and then Queen Vashti, okay, which was his wife, which was the queen, also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. Okay, the men and the women wouldn't come together, so there are two different parties going on here. So he had an open house for 6 months, showing off his greatness, his wealth, his power, and then after that threw a big 7-day banquet for all. Now you might also notice at various times another name that this king is known by, and that's Ahasuerus. Okay, Ahasuerus means mighty prince. Okay, mighty prince. Vashti, the queen, that name means beauty, which you would expect a great king to have a beautiful wife. So how this banquet went on for 7 days. On the 7th day, it ended on a sour note. What happened? Verse 10. On the 7th day, when King Xerxes was in high spirits from wine, in other words, kind of south, right? He commanded the 7 eunuchs who served him to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. That's what her name was, too, was beauty. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. It doesn't give us the reason why she refused to come, whether she was busy with her own party, with the women, whether she decided that she didn't want to go parading, it was beneath her to go parade in front of all these drunken men, or just what. But she refused to come. And you see, the king's response was that he was furious and burned with anger. Why? Why was it such a big deal to him? Well, it wasn't such a big deal just to him, but also to the Persians, to the other people. Verse 16. I'll start at verse 15. King Xerxes asked his nobles and his officials, he says, according to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? She has not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Well, then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they'll despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she wouldn't come. This very day, the Persian and Median women of the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Okay, so this was a huge threat to the nation because women everywhere would follow the queen's lead and disobey their husbands, and the whole nation would crumble, right? Okay. Well, what did Xerxes do to prevent this disaster for the disaster of the world? Verse 19. Memucan said, "Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who's better than she." Okay, you've got to make a point here with this king, or else the whole nation will suffer, right? Well, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice, so the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatchers to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in its own language, proclaiming in each people's tongue that every man should be ruler over his own household. Okay, if you didn't get the point of what I'm doing with Vashti by deposing her as queen, then here's the point. Every man should be ruler over his own household. All women need to obey their husbands. Okay? Very important lesson. Okay, so how was Xerxes then able to find a suitable replacement for Queen Vashti? She was beautiful. She was a great hostess, we saw. She hosted her own party and banquet, and he had to replace her. So how would he find a suitable replacement? Chapter 2. Later, when the anger of King Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. So the king's personal attendants proposed, "Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king." Okay. Then let these girls be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let the beauty treatments be given to him. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. Well, this advice appealed to the king, and so he followed it. And then jumping to verse 12, "Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics." So it was a beauty college that they had to go to learn and to prepare themselves to be beautiful for the king. Okay. So they went and they rounded up all these young women from various nationalities that were there in Persia, and they went through this year of training. Well, who was one of these girls? Verse 5. "Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, the son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish," okay, "who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features, and Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died." So there's this Jewish girl, and going on, verse 8, "When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Hegai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge of the harem." Okay, so Esther was a young girl, a Jewish girl, very lovely in form and features. Her name, her Jewish name, her Hebrew name was Hadassah. Okay, we've seen, like with Daniel and Azariah, Hananiah, and Mishael, that was their Hebrew names, their Jewish names, but then their names were changed to Babylonian names of Belteshazzar, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. We saw that in the book of Daniel. And so having a couple of names is not uncommon. In fact, we don't know his Jewish name, his Hebrew name, but Mordecai, this guy who is Esther's cousin, his name is a Babylonian name named after Marduk, the chief Babylonian god, also known as Bel. And Mordecai is his name. And references to him have been found in archaeology, Mordecai. So it's interesting. So his cousin was named Hadassah, which means myrtle. Okay, like a crepe myrtle. Her Persian name was Esther, which means star. Okay, a little better than Myrtle, I guess. So she was a star. And how did this star turn out in this competition? Verse 17. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than to any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. So Esther became queen. She was the one who replaced Vashti. Now she's a Jew. She's not a Persian. How could a Jew, she's not even a Babylonian, how could a Jew become queen of the Persian Empire? Verse 10. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. They didn't know that she was a Jew. Okay? And you also see here that Mordecai stayed in touch with her as she was going through the training and also after she became queen. Now, he was very concerned with her. He had taken care of her. And she, even though he was her cousin, he was basically also her dad because he raised her when her father and mother died. We saw that in verse 7. So, how did Mordecai's concern for Esther end up helping to save the king, Xerxes? Chapter 2, verse 21. During the time that Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, and Mordecai, we see here in verse 19, was sitting at the king's gate, which means that he was probably some kind of an official. He had some kind of responsibility because it was the officials who sat at the king's gate, who sat at the gate to the city to judge things or to conduct official business. That's where the business was conducted. So while he was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry, and they conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on a gallows. All this was recorded in the Book of the Annals in the presence of the king. So he heard of a plot to assassinate the king, and so he reported it to Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And so there he saved the life of the king, and his name was recorded in the record books of being one who saved the king here. Okay? All right, chapter 3. We've got a new guy coming in here, a guy named Haman. Okay? And through Haman, we see that Mordecai's faithfulness to God gets him and others in trouble. Let's look at that, chapter 3. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. By the way, he's an Agagite, which is understood to be a descendant of King Agag, who was the king of the Amalekites that Saul did not destroy. God had commanded him to destroy the Amalekites, and he didn't. He saved the best, and that was part of his problem. Well, we see now that the Agagites, the Amalekites, create problems for the Jews here, some major problems, which we'll see as we keep going on. So Haman was elevated by King Xerxes. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor to Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor. When Haman saw that Mordecai would not kneel down or pay him honor, he was enraged. Yet having learned who Mordecai's people were, he scorned the idea of killing only Mordecai. Instead, Haman looked for a way to destroy all Mordecai's people, the Jews, throughout the entire kingdom of Xerxes. So he refused to bow down to Haman. Haman then decided, rather than just getting vengeance on Mordecai and punishing him for not bowing down, he decided to destroy off that entire race of people, to destroy the Jews. Now this all happened in verse 7. This happened in the 12th year of Xerxes, where we saw that it was in the third year, in verse 16 of chapter 2, when Esther became queen. So this was 4 years later, so some time has passed. So Haman wants to destroy the Jews. How would he do that? He can't just go out and destroy the Jews, even though he is respected by the king and second to the king. The king's not going to let him do that. He's got to. How would he get Xerxes' approval to do that? Verse 8. Well, then Haman said to King Xerxes, King, there's a certain people dispersed and scattered among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom whose customs are different from all those of all the other people and who do not obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, then let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I'll put 10,000 talents of silver into the royal treasury for the men who carry out this business. So he showed how serious he was, that he would put 375 tons, that's what the 10,000 talents is, of silver in the royal treasury to pay for this annihilation of these people who do not obey the king's laws, he said. Okay, so that shows he's very serious. And so he warned the king of this national threat, and he said, it's so important, I'll pay for it. Well, verse 11, keep the money, the king said to Haman, and do with the people as you please. So he trusted Haman, and he gave him the authority to do that, to get rid of these people. So how would he do it? Verse 13, dispatches were sent by couriers to all the king's provinces with the order to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the Jews, young and old, women and little children, on a single day, the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, and to plunder their goods. So this decree went out, this law went out, telling all people everywhere in the Persian Empire to that on this particular day, the 13th day of the 12th month, to kill off the Jews and to take their goods. Okay, that would kind of be their payment, is the goods there. Now, if you look back, this happened, this says this would be in the 12th month. Well, in verse 7, we see that this was all in the first month, so quite a bit of time passed. Why did he pick that day? Well, let's look at verse 7. In the 12th year of King Xerxes, in the first month, the month of Nisan, they cast the pur, that is, the lots. The word pur means lot, in the presence of Haman to select a day and a month. And the lot fell on the 12th month, the month of Adar. So the reason that it was so almost a year later was not just to have time for the word to get out there, but because that's what the lot threw. When they threw the lot, it's kind of like throwing dice. And they threw the pur, or they threw a few dice, so it would be called the purim. I-M is how you would pluralize a noun. And so purim means dice or lots. Okay, and that's how he picked that date. So that decree went out. Well, that decree went out and was announced to everyone, including the Jews who were scattered around. They heard about it. So how did they respond? Chapter 4. When Mordecai learned of all that had been done, he tore his clothes, put on sackcloth and ashes, and went into the city, wailing loudly and bitterly. But he went only as far as the king's gate, because no one clothed in sackcloth was allowed to enter it. In every province to which the edict and order of the king came, there was great mourning among the Jews, with fasting and weeping and wailing. Many lay in sackcloth and ashes. So you see, they were devastated. They were in distress because of this impending Holocaust. You thought that Hitler's efforts were strong. This here was an edict from the king that everybody would get involved in. All the Jews that existed at that time were there in the Persian Empire. So this would be a total annihilation, a total Holocaust of the Jewish people. Almost 2,500 years before the Holocaust that you think about with Hitler. But you know, there happens to be a queen who happens to be part of this race. It's a Jew. So she could stop it, right? Why didn't she? Why couldn't she? Why couldn't Esther just go talk to Xerxes and ask for his help? Verse 11. Esther sent word to Mordecai saying, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and to spare his life. But you know, 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. So she couldn't just go walk up to the king and ask him to stop this annihilation of her people, because her life was at risk. If she just went to the king, if he wasn't ready to see her, the punishment for her to show up like that, unannounced or uninvited, was death. Okay, so there was great risk. How did Mordecai convince her that she should put her neck on the line and go to Xerxes? Verse 12. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back this answer. Do not think that because you're in the king's house that you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arrive from another place. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to a royal position for such a time as this. Okay? God's going to deliver his people somehow. This may be why you're queen. This may be why you're in the position that you're in, is so that you can bring the salvation to the Jews. For her to do this, she wanted some help. What kind of help did she want? Going on. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Okay, go and gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast as you do. When this is done, I'll go to the king, even though it's against the law. And if I perish, I perish. Okay? So pray for me. Fast and pray for me. Okay? For 3 days, for God to be with me, for God to protect me, and to God to guide me, and for God to bring success in this request. Okay? So they do that. And chapter 5, on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the palace in front of the king's hall. The king was sitting on his royal throne in the hall facing the entrance. Okay? So she goes, and how does he respond? When he saw Queen Esther standing in the court, he was pleased with her, and he held out to her the gold scepter that was in his hand. So Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. Then the king asked, "What is it, Queen Esther? What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it'll be given to you." Okay, so he was very pleased with her. He was glad to see her and anxious to give her whatever she wanted. Okay, you name it. You got it. Okay. Well, so what was her request? Verse 4. "If it pleases the king," replied Esther, "then let the king, together with Haman, come today to a banquet that I've prepared for him." "Oh, bring Haman at once," the king said, "so that we may do whatever Esther asks here." So the king and Haman went to the banquet that Esther had prepared. So you see, she doesn't make the request right now. She's buttering him up, right? She makes this great banquet, and she invites the king and Haman to that banquet. So does she make a request then? Verse 6. As they were drinking wine, the king again asked Esther, "Okay, now, what is your petition? It'll be given to you. And what's your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it'll be granted." Esther replied, "Well, my petition and my request is this." You see, she gets a little cold feet here, I guess. "If the king regards me as with favor, and if it pleases the king to grant my petition and fulfill my request, well then, let the king and Haman come tomorrow to the banquet that I'll prepare for them. And then, I'll answer the king's question." Okay? We don't know why she delayed like this, whether she was nervous about it or just what, but she wasn't quite ready to ask. And so she invites them to another banquet the next day, both of them, the king and Haman. Well, you know, this was kind of a surprise to Haman, right? How did he feel about being invited by the queen to the banquet today and the banquet tomorrow? Verse 11, "Haman boasted to his friends and his wife about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways that the king had honored him and how he had elevated him above the other nobles and officials. And that's not all," Haman added. "I'm the only person that Queen Esther has invited to accompany the king to the banquet that she gave. And she's invited me along with the king tomorrow." Okay, so he was proud of his greatness. He was just big-headed here. How did his big head, what did that lead him to do? He goes on and says, "But all this gives me no satisfaction as long as I see that Jew Mordecai sitting at the king's gate." His wife Zeresh and his friend said to him, "Oh, well, have a gallows built. Build a big one, 75 feet high. And ask the king in the morning to have Mordecai hanged on it. And then go with the king to the dinner and be happy." So the suggestion delighted Haman, and he had the gallows built. Okay? So even though he's prescribed that all the Jews are going to die because he doesn't like Mordecai, he just can't wait till the end of the year to see Mordecai killed with all the others. And so his friends and wife suggest, we'll take care of him here. So, he does so. He has this gallows built. Well, meanwhile, back at the ranch, back in the palace, that night, chapter 6, the king could not sleep. So, you know, he gets some sleeping medicine. Well, back then they didn't have sleeping pills. Instead, what did he do? He ordered that the book of the Chronicles, the record of his reign, to be brought in and read to him. If that doesn't put you to sleep, I don't know what will. It was found recorded there that Mordecai had exposed Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who had guarded the doorway, who had conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. And that's what we saw back at the end of chapter 2. So he ran across the story about how Mordecai had saved the king from being assassinated. Okay. So, what honor and recognition has Mordecai received for this? The king asked. Well, nothing's been done for him, the attendants answered. So he's thinking, you know, I did this. He saved my life. I never did anything for him, huh? So he's thinking about that and realizing that Mordecai had never been rewarded for saving him. Just at that time, who happens to walk in? What happens here? Verse 6. When Haman entered, the king asked him, Haman, what should be done for the man who the king delights to honor? I don't know if Haman thought to himself, oh, who's there that the king would rather honor than me? So he thought up something really good. So he answered the king, well, for the man that the king delights to honor, have them bring a royal robe that the king has worn and a horse that the king has ridden, one with a royal crest placed on its head. And then let the robe and horse be entrusted to one of the king's most noble princes. Let them robe the man that the king delights to honor and lead him on the horse through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man that the king delights to honor. So here the king, Xerxes, is wanting to honor Mordecai because Mordecai saved his life, but Haman is thinking he's going to honor him. So what happens? Verse 10. Oh, go at once, the king commanded Haman. Get the robe and the horse and do just as you have suggested for Mordecai, the Jew who sits at the king's gate. Do not neglect anything that you have recommended. Can you just see Haman now? His reaction to this? Here, he's over the night, he had this big 75-foot-tall gallows built to hang Mordecai. And now the king is telling him he wants to honor Mordecai. And by the way, you're the one who needs to do it. You're the one who needs to put him on this horse and put my robe on him and walk in front of him throughout all the streets of Susa and announce to everyone that the king wants to honor Mordecai. This is the guy that Haman hates more than anybody. Okay? Going on. So Haman got the robe and the horse because he couldn't disobey the king. He robed Mordecai and led him on horseback through the city streets, proclaiming before him, this is what is done for the man the king delights to honor. Afterward, Mordecai returned to the king's gate, but Haman rushed home with his head covered in grief. And he told Zeresh, his wife, and all his friends everything that had happened to him. His advisors and his wife Zeresh said to him, oh, since Mordecai, before whom your downfall has started, is of Jewish origin, you cannot stand against him. You will certainly come to ruin. So they saw this as a sign that it was doomsday for Haman. What goes on next? Well, while they were still talking with him, the king's eunuchs arrived and hurried Haman away to the banquet that Esther had prepared. And so what happens there at the banquet? Chapter 7, verse 3. Queen Esther answered the king and said, if I found favor with you, O king, and if it pleases your majesty, grant me... You know, when the king asked, what do you want? He said, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. So she has a petition and a request. Okay, her petition that she's begging for is her own life. And her request is not just her life, but to save the lives of her people. Okay? She goes on to say, for I and my people have been sold for destruction and slaughter and annihilation. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. But someone is forcing us to be annihilated. Well, how did Xerxes respond to this? King Xerxes asks Queen Esther, who is he? Where is the man who has dared to do such a thing? Esther said, the adversary and enemy is this vile Haman. Well, then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen, naturally so. The king got up in a rage, left his wine, went out to the palace garden. But Haman, realizing that the king had already decided his fate, stayed behind to beg Queen Esther for her life. Now, this is the kind of king that doesn't pull any punches, and when he makes a decision, he makes a decision. So he was mad. So when he went out to the courtyard garden to think about it and think to help make his decision. But Haman stayed behind trying to beg Esther for his life. And then what happens? Just as the king returned from the palace garden to the banquet hall, Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was reclining. The king exclaimed, will he even molest the queen while she's with me in the house? As soon as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. Then Harbona, one of the eunuchs attending the king, said, a gallows 75 feet high stands by Haman's house. He had it made for Mordecai, who spoke up to help the king. This shows you how bad this guy is. He was planning on hanging the guy that that you just honored. The king said, hang him on it. So they hanged Haman on the gallows he had prepared for Mordecai. Then the king's fury subsided. So he had him hung. And there Mordecai received the treatment that he had planned for, or Haman received the treatment that he had planned for Mordecai. Well, how else did Xerxes try to right Haman's wrongs against Esther and Mordecai? Chapter 8. That same day, King Xerxes gave Queen Esther the estate of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, and Mordecai came into the presence of the king, for Esther had told him how he was related to her. The king took off his signet ring, which he had claimed from Haman, and presented it to Mordecai. And Esther appointed him over Haman's estate. So all that Haman had owned, this great wealth that he had, was given to the queen, was given to Esther, and she brought Mordecai in to take care of the estate. And you see that out of thanks for what he's done and trust through Esther, the king gives his signet ring, which denotes his power, to Mordecai. Well, did Xerxes' justice satisfy Esther? Verse 3. Esther again pleaded with the king, falling at his feet and weeping. She begged him to put an end to the evil plan of Haman the Agagite, which he had devised against the Jews. Okay, her desire wasn't necessarily that Haman be killed. That wasn't her petition. Her petition was that she not be killed and her people not be killed. So that still exists there. So she begs him. Well, there's a problem with that. He cannot do that. The king cannot just cancel that decree, right? Because that decree was sent in his name. Turn to Daniel 6, verse 15. We saw this last week. It says, the men went to the group, to the Persian king then, and said to him, remember, O king, that according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, no decree or edict that the king issues can be changed. And that was a law of the Persians. You know, the Babylonians, King Nebuchadnezzar, he could make and break his own laws as much as he wanted and change them as much as he wants. But the Persians couldn't. Once they made a law, everybody had to abide by it. Could not be repealed, could not be changed. Not even the king could change it. So what did Xerxes decide to do to solve this dilemma? Verse 7. King Xerxes replied to Queen Esther and to Mordecai the Jew, because Haman attacked the Jews, I've given his estate to Esther, and they've hanged him on the gallows. Now, write another decree in the king's name in behalf of the Jews, however it seems best to you, and seal it with the king's signet ring, for no document written in the king's name and sealed with his ring can be revoked. So he leaves it to them, says, y'all decide. Y'all figure out what law you need to make that will take care of this for you. Okay? So they make a law. And what is that law? Verse 11. The king's edict granted the Jews in every city the right to assemble and protect themselves, to destroy, kill, and annihilate any armed force of any nationality or province that might attack them and their women and children, and to plunder the property of their enemies. The day appointed for the Jews to do this in all the provinces of King Xerxes was the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar. So they were given the right to defend themselves on March 7th. So what was the day that the Jews were supposed to be annihilated? You turn back to chapter 3, It was going to be the 13th day of the 12th month. So on that same day, the Jews were given the ability to defend themselves. So that edict went out, and we see in the last verse of chapter 8 that in every province and every city, wherever the edict of the king went, there was joy and gladness among the Jews with feasting and celebrating. And many people of other nationalities became Jews because they were afraid of the Jews, because of fear of the Jews had seized them. So there were a lot of enemies to the Jews, and the Jews had the right to fight those enemies on that day. And so many people said, hey, I'm not your enemy. So a lot of people became Jews to get on their side. So what happened? Chapter 9. On the 13th day of the 12th month, the month of Adar, the edict commanded by the king was to be carried out. On this day, the enemies of the Jews had hoped to overpower them, but now the tables were turned, and the Jews got the upper hand over those who hated them. The Jews assembled in their cities in all the provinces of King Xerxes to attack those seeking their destruction. No one could stand against them because the people of all the other nationalities were afraid of them. And all the nobles of the provinces, the satraps, the governors, and the king's administrators helped the Jews because the fear of Mordecai had seized them. Mordecai had some pretty strong power then. Okay, Mordecai was prominent in the palace, verse 4. His reputation spread throughout the provinces, and he became more and more powerful. So that by the time of this date, the 13th day of the 12th month, more people supported the Jews than opposed them. And verse 5, the Jews struck down all their enemies with the sword, killing and destroying them, and did what they pleased to those who hated them. Including the next verses, they killed the 10 sons of Haman. What's interesting is they did not lay their hands on the plunder. The bottom of verse 10, and also we see that elsewhere in verse 15, that they did not put their hands on the plunder. And verse 16, the people who were not in Susa, out in the rest of the empire, did that as well. So they defended themselves against their enemies, but they didn't take the plunder. That wasn't the purpose of this. Well, this is a great saving act of God. God saved them, protected them through this. How were they to remember this great saving act of God? Chapter 9, verse 20. Mordecai recorded these events, and he sent letters to all the Jews throughout the provinces of King Xerxes, near and far, to have them celebrate annually the 14th and 15th days of the month of Adar, at the time when the Jews got relief from their enemies, as the month when their sorrow was turned into joy and their mourning into a day of celebration. He wrote them to observe the days as days of feasting, of joy, of giving presents of food to one another, and of giving gifts to the poor. So an annual festival was set up for the 14th and 15th day of Adar. The day 14th would be the day after the 13th when they had success. Now, in Susa, back in verse 14, we see that the king permitted the Jews to have a second day. And so in Susa. So in Susa, they were able to do it on the 13th and 14th to take care of their enemies. And so that means that they then rested on the 15th. And even today, depending on if you're in a big city or not, may decide which day, the 8th or the 9th of March, that you celebrate Purim. What was this festival called? I just told you. Verse 24. Haman, the son of Hammedar the Agagite, the enemy of all the Jews, had plotted against the Jews to destroy them and cast the pur, that is the lot, for their ruin and destruction. Okay, therefore these days were called Purim, from the word pure, so lots. Because of everything written in this letter and because of what they had seen and what it took for them to happen. The Jews took upon themselves to establish the custom that they and their descendants and all who joined them should without fail observe these 2 days every year in the way prescribed and at the time appointed. So this is called the Feast of Purim, the Festival of Purim. And it's celebrated today. How was a regular Jew like Mordecai able to command the setting of this great festival? Chapter 10. Verse 3, Mordecai the Jew was second in rank to King Xerxes, preeminent among the Jews and held in high esteem by his many fellow Jews, because he worked for the good of his people and spoke up for the welfare of all the Jews. So you see that he was placed second in command to King Xerxes, just like Haman had been, and was very trusted and very powerful, and he took care of the Jews and protected them, and so they followed his command to follow this feast. How Purim is celebrated today, you really get more detail on pages 5 and 6 of your handout. Okay, there's just some details about what's done today. A central part of the celebration is hearing the reading of the book of Esther multiple times. That is called the Megillah, which you'll see on pages 5 and 6. It's talked about that when they read the book of Esther as the Megillah. And when they read it, children act out the story. Okay, and so they're wearing costumes, and elaborate costumes are made and worn. The great heroes that everybody wants to dress up as are Esther and Mordecai. The great villain is Haman, and whenever Haman's name is mentioned, a lot of noise is made. People boo, they stamp on the floor, they beat pots and pans, they spin these Purim noisemakers. You've seen them that spin and make noise. The reason they stamp on the floor is they'll write the word Haman on the bottoms of their shoes, and they'll stamp on it and grind their soles into the floor to stamp out Haman. They have these triangular pastries that represent Haman's hat, and they eat those to get rid of Haman, to show their dislike of Haman. Okay? So that is the story behind the Feast of Purim. That is the story of Esther. Let's close with prayer. God, our Father, we thank you for the story of Esther. We thank you for seeing how, in the life of an individual, a young girl named Esther, that you worked through the circumstances of her life, put things in motion so that she, unbeknownst to her, could come and save the Jews. That through her, you saved your people. Through many people, you have saved your people. Through us, you call us to take your message of salvation to other people. Use us as you used Esther to bring salvation to your people. Work your spirit in our lives so that we can be effective, just as you made Esther effective when she approached the king. Effective through prayer and fasting, through turning to you, that she was made effective before the king. Make us effective when we go before others who need to hear the great message of salvation that you've brought to us through your Son, Jesus Christ. In his name we pray. Amen.